The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, five non-profit groups have taken the State of Israel to court, accusing authorities of restricting the entry of aid and failing to respect their obligations as an occupying power to provide basic necessities to the citizens. Now, it comes as conditions worsen across the Gaza Strip, with famine conditions hitting parts of that country. We're joined now by Tess Ingram, a UNICEF spokesperson who is currently in Rafah. Good morning, Tess.
Good morning, Pat.
Can you describe the conditions you have found in Rafah?
On top of all of the known, the decay of buildings, the waste, the lack of food and clean water, the thing that shocked me the most being back this time, Pat, is the despair, is people's mental health and how quickly it's deteriorating. I feel hope slipping out from under people, particularly with talk of a ground offensive in Rafah. Families are scared and they don't know where they'll go. So on top of the bombs and the bullets, on top of the humanitarian crisis, people are now losing hope, and that's really worrying.
Now, Netanyahu himself has said, in spite of criticism from Joe Biden, no force in the world will stop them going into Rafah.
That would be an absolute catastrophe if that happened. We need to make sure that the international community does everything it can, despite those words, to make sure that Rafah is protected. Failing that, that people in Rafah are safe. And that's really, really difficult because there is no safe place in Gaza for them to go. I've spent lots of time this week in different parts of the Gaza Strip, and I've spoken to children and their families who've been killed or injured in Al-Mawasi, which is a supposed safe zone, in Deir Abalar, in the middle area, where, you know, there's reports that people could be sent back. So I think that there's nowhere for these people to go, and therefore a ground offensive in Rafah would cost thousands of more children their lives.
Now, we've also read that the Israeli Defense Forces are purchasing 40,000 tents. So it does indicate what they see happening is that they will obviously be setting up tent towns for the people evacuated from Rafah, with whatever consequence.
Look, I can't comment on their strategy, and I know that, you know, the UN has said that we don't participate in forced evacuations. I have seen those reports, and I have seen that comments that there might be a move to move people in with those tents to the middle area. And again, that would just be a catastrophe. Some of the families that I've met, Pat, have moved six or seven times already. They're exhausted. These families involve children who may have been injured or are malnourished or are sick. It's very difficult for them to move again on top of everything else that they're facing. So I think we just need to do everything we can to make sure that people are allowed to stay in Rafah and that they are safe.
Can you describe what a typical family might be going through in Rafah? I mean, is any of Rafah working normally with sanitation, with running water, or is most of it effectively like a makeshift refugee camp?
So there are, you know, some homes of the people who were originally living in this town of 250,000 to 300,000 people. But of course, on top of that, there are now more than a million people displaced here, and it really is like a tent city. There are sheets of plastic everywhere, housing people. The sanitation is really poor. The water systems are not functioning properly. There is some food available but for sale by street-side vendors, but it's very expensive compared to what it was before, and the liquidity of cash is becoming a real issue here. So for families in Gaza, particularly those who are displaced and living in a makeshift shelter, life is incredibly difficult. They spend a lot of their days looking for food and water and trying to protect their children, not just from the offensive, because, of course, there's still strikes on Rafah at the moment, Pat. I'm here and I can hear them. Also from the humanitarian crisis, from catching a disease that might kill them.
Now, we know in the wake of the killing of seven members of the aid agency World Central Kitchen that promises were made by Israel to open up aid routes, a number of different aid routes into Gaza. To what extent has that happened? Because they are talking about, you know, between 400 and 500 trucks getting in on a given day. What is happening on the ground?
So we take a close look at the aid trucks that are coming in. That's what's important to us. And we know that the number of aid trucks in the last week is still far too low. We're looking at, you know, an average maybe of around 160, 180 trucks a day, which is a slight improvement from last month, but nowhere near enough. 500 trucks a day used to come into the Gaza Strip before the war. So we need to make sure that the volume of aid continues to increase. And as you say, that these crossings that are meant to open in the north do open and open at scale, because the two crossings at the moment are in the south. And so in relation to that World Central Kitchen tragedy, we're trying to bring aid through a hostile conflict zone. If we can get an opening in the north to bring food directly there to the malnourished children who we know are dying, then that could be a real game changer.
Now, the Israelis always claim that sufficient aid would be allowed in and is being allowed in, but they are convinced that much of it is purloined by Hamas and doesn't get to the people who need it. And yet the systems that they've imposed in terms of vetting trucks and so on is such that you'd imagine that the bona fides of each truck would be well established by the Israelis before they enter Gaza.
Yeah, we go through a very, very stringent process in terms of what's allowed in. We pre-approve everything with Israel. We send them brochures, pictures, dimensions of what's going to be in the truck. So nothing is loaded onto a truck that they haven't already approved. And despite that, we have items that are turned away with very little explanation or no explanation at all. And that's really difficult. It also means that the process is really slow, Pat, because they open every box, they screen everything, despite having pre-approved everything. And it really means that trucks spend sometimes weeks waiting to come in when we hope that they could move in a matter of days.
Now, when they do get into the Gaza Strip, how hazardous is the journey to the people who need the aid?
This is, without a doubt, one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a humanitarian worker, and probably the most difficult operating conditions at the moment in terms of distributing humanitarian aid for a number of reasons. Safety is, of course, one. The volatility and the intensity of the fighting puts us at risk, but also the people that, you know, we're here to serve. But on top of that, we have ongoing restrictions on where we can travel. Telecommunications continue to be interrupted. Roads are damaged and we have to reroute several times while on a mission. So it's really difficult, and it's even harder for us to get to the north than it is to deliver aid in the south, because of the journey that we have to make from those southern crossings to the really vulnerable children and families in the north.
Now, we heard about airdrops. Are they still proceeding? Which are the countries that are providing this aid? And is it effective or is it tokenistic?
I think there have been some recent airdrops. But, you know, as the UN, we're more focused on the land routes, because for us, that's the most efficient way to get aid into the Gaza Strip at scale. It's cost effective, it's fast, and you can get far much more on a truck or on several trucks than you can via air or even via the sea. So it's much better for us if everybody focuses on putting the necessary pressure to make sure that these land routes are opened and that they operate at scale.
What about medical aid? We know that what used to go in probably wasn't enough anyway, but what is going in now, what are the consequences of deficits? I'm thinking of people maybe who have chronic conditions that they were able to manage before this war, things like diabetes. What happens to patients like that?
I met a little boy actually in a hospital this week, Mustafa, and he has diabetes and hasn't been able to get the insulin that he needs. And so he keeps having to be admitted to the ICU. He was very sick. And it wasn't the first time that he'd spent time there at the European hospital. So, and this is one of so many cases, Pat, of people with pre-existing conditions, whether that's, you know, kidney issues or cancer or a raft of things that they're not able to get the treatment that they need. I also spoke to a doctor who was telling me that in his maternity hospital, more and more babies are being born preterm or with congenital issues because of the mother's health. And he said that it's very difficult for them to try and keep those babies alive. They lose 3 a day because they might have a heart condition that requires surgery that they can't perform in Gaza, and medical evacuation is very, very difficult. So on top of the trauma and the injury from the war, the lack of resources for hospitals and the lack of staff for hospitals is really having an impact on people as well.
Now, you mentioned medical evacuations. How many people are actually allowed out of Gaza? How many get into Egypt? What is the attitude of the Egyptian authorities?
Look, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I do know that it's obviously very difficult, that, you know, this is a place that is fenced, and that unless people have the means to pay a lot of money to leave, or they're on a long list for medical evacuations, that they have no choice but to remain here.
Now, you mentioned the mental health difficulties that are occurring because people are so depressed and despondent. But do they see any glimmers of hope anywhere? I mean, do they depend on the United States somehow wielding a big stick to make Netanyahu pause?
I think that the people of Gaza are not so invested in the international politics, because to them, it's not complicated, it's simple. It's simple because they just want the fighting to stop through whatever means necessary. So we don't have conversations like that. We just talk about their basic survival and their simple hope that this will end sometime soon. And they do have hope, Pat, but it is slipping away.
But it is slipping away. Tess, how is it for people like yourself? You're there on behalf of UNICEF and you're observing and you're speaking and you're telling the world. But that in itself is a hazardous activity.
It is. But, you know, what we keep telling ourselves is that when it's dangerous for us, it's more dangerous for the children. And I see that at all of the hospitals I go to. Some of the injuries I've seen this week, Pat, are just horrific, and they'll stay with me forever. And these are small kids who were just in their homes or walking down the street and were very badly injured. So that's why we're here. That's why we're doing the work. And, you know, it's frustrating that we aren't able to do everything that we can to save these children's lives on the ground. We know how to do this. We do this all around the world, but we're being hampered here, and it's affecting our ability to help people. And two, it's frustrating that this is still going more than 6 months. It's why we've been so relentless about a need for a ceasefire. It's got to end now.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of what is left of Gaza. I mean, we know the destruction that happened in Gaza City. The Israelis moved out of Khan Yunis, and more than a third of the buildings are destroyed. And the people of Rafah, I presume, are observing this either through, you know, mobile phones or whatever. They know what has happened to the land they called home and what they anticipate might happen to Rafah.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of them are from the north. They've seen what's happened in the north of, you know, essentially being reduced to rubble. And then again, in Khan Yunis, it's like this looming tornado that's coming towards them. And you can imagine how frightening that would be as a parent, just trying day in, day out to keep your child alive, moving away repeatedly from fighting that continues to follow you. People are exhausted and running out of coping mechanisms.
Tess, thank you very much for taking our call. Tess Ingram of UNICEF, thank you very, very much for joining us from Rafah.
Thanks a lot, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.